Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
Hello, sunshine.
Hey, fam. Today on The Bright Side, we're tagging along with the girls on the bus. Journalist and best-selling author Amy Chozick is talking about the new TV series inspired by her memoir and the power of seeing women in politics on screen.
It's Wednesday, April 17th. I'm Danielle Robay.
And I'm Simone Boyce. And this is The Bright Side from Hello, Sunshine.
All right, here's your morning drip. This one is for our Swifties. Taylor Swift is teaming up with Spotify to create an open-air poetry library.
Interesting.
It's for the release of her upcoming album, The Tortured Poets Department, which is coming out this Friday, the 19th.
That is going to take over our algorithms on Friday.
Yes, it is. I actually really like this. I love poetry. You know, you and I share a love for beautiful words. And I think Taylor, if anybody, has the ability to make poetry quote-unquote cool or bring it mainstream. The library is going to be at the Grove in LA on April 16th, 17th, and 18th. But don't worry if you're not in LA. All the surprises and hints that are going to be there will also be available on her album countdown page.
All right, so we all saw that Caitlin Clark is going pro. And that transition, well, it's proving that the gender pay gap is still so real, especially for female athletes. Ugh. Earlier this week, the Indiana Fever selected her first overall in the WNBA draft, but it's honestly her paycheck that's making headlines. So she signed a four-year, $338,000 contract, which means that she's making less than $100,000 in her first year.
Yeah.
And every year after that. So just for comparison, the number one pick in the 2023 men's draft was Victor Wembanyama, and he signed a $55 million contract, so $12 million for his rookie season. We're talking about astronomical differences here, not even in the same realm of comparison.
The challenge is the inequality here is so foundational.
Yes.
It's based on ticket sales, is what they say. But what makes up ticket sales? Players that are stars, and what makes star players? Buy-in from brands, time on TV. Think about how many hours people in sports television and radio talk about Tom Brady versus Serena Williams. Like, the gap is so real there. And so it makes this whole thing very tricky.
Listen, this is a huge systemic issue, but the good news is that Caitlin stands to make additional monies through her name, image, and likeness deals. She's probably going to make millions from that. So hopefully this marks a turning point for athletes like her.
I hope so, but I think it's going to take a little bit of time. I mean, this is why Brittany Griner was playing in Russia. A lot of these WNBA players have to go play overseas because they can't sustain their life on WNBA salaries. I mean, Caitlin was the number one pick, and that's what she's making. Can you imagine what the 200 and something pick is making? Like, a lot of it is just not sustainable. And so, similar to how we talk about the pay gap in general, it just needs to be sped up.
Brands, this is on you. It is time to step up. Make sure our girl Caitlin Clark stays paid, okay? We love to see Prada dressing her. That was such a cool moment. Let's keep it up, okay, folks?
Okay, also in the world of sports, photos of Nike's new women's Olympic track uniforms are going absolutely viral. And Simone, it's for all the wrong reasons. Nike recently debuted its line of uniforms for athletes, and one of the options for women's track and field immediately sparked outrage. They were these unitard bikini line sort of high-waisted numbers.
Extremely high.
Yeah, I don't know how to explain it. They're like bikini bottoms.
If you haven't seen it, look up an image of it, but it's even more revealing than a bikini bottom. The fabric sort of arches inward, like towards the belly button, and then it like goes back out and over the hip. But it's such a severe cut that I can't imagine how any athlete would be able to perform confidently and comfortably in this.
Yeah, it's revealing. And there's a side-by-side of the men's fit, and it's like a full uniform onesie. And so people are just pissed.
I'm pissed.
Yeah,
I can't. Know. I don't belong anywhere near a track, and I'm pissed. I just think this is so insulting. And Nike, you could have just put the men's uniform side by side next to the women's uniform. You could have made them the exact same. There is no reason why the women have to be in this skimpy uniform.
Well, I just think about how I like to show up to work. And if I'm not in an outfit that I feel comfortable in, I'm definitely not going to do my best job. And so for these athletes who have worked their entire lives to get to this moment, they're then hit with this. It just seems so unnecessary.
Okay, I hope you're thirsty, Danielle, because this next story is it's an interesting one that I've seen all over TikTok and Instagram right now. And that is adults using breast milk for their own health benefits. So we've seen bodybuilders do it. They say that it helps them gain muscle. There are lots of videos of people using breast milk and even frozen breast milk as a face treatment or a toner. And then just recently, Kourtney Kardashian shared that she, quote, pounded a glass of breast milk when she started feeling sick, because we know that breast milk has a lot of immune boosting properties, especially for infants. So I don't know. I think it's still a little bit cloudy, but I'm all for it. Like, why not? It's not going to hurt you, especially like with Kourtney Kardashian. It's her breast milk.
It was controversial. People were mad at her.
I think people have strong opinions about breast milk in general, about like sharing breast milk. Like, I just saw a video where a woman's sister was feeding her baby with her own breast milk. And there are a lot of strong opinions about that. But I think if we were to look back throughout history, this probably wouldn't have been that weird. I think we have a lot of weird feelings about it now.
I have zero weird feelings about it. There's tons of philanthropy programs that are all about women donating breast milk because they call it liquid gold for a reason. It has so many healing properties. So I'm into this. I'm also the type of person that would eat my own placenta. I eat like brown bananas. I have like things in my fridge are definitely expired that I'll still eat. I grew up like that. Like, my mom would always be like, I'd be like, oh, the milk says it's 3 days old. And she's like, oh, they put the wrong labels on. They're just being too careful. Yeah, I would totally. I'll drink your breast milk. I'll drink my breast milk. I'm good with anything.
When I was breastfeeding my son, a friend came over and she was like, can I have a glass of breast milk? And she drank it right there on the spot. So
she's still alive? All good?
Of course. It's like super juice in there, baby.
Did you have Michael try it?
I think so. Yeah, I think I made him try it. I actually remember using a little bit of breast milk on my face when I was dealing with like post-pregnancy acne. And I don't know that it actually helped, but it's like, why not?
Why not try it? This story is not controversial to me. It's just breast milk. It's like, it's so natural. And it's amazing that some of us have the ability to make it.
Yes. I also remember using it on my kids whenever they had a cut or something, or I would put it in the bathtub with them. It's great for skin. I think just the fact that we're talking about this is great because I would love to see more scientific studies about the benefits of breast milk. I think there are a lot more that we probably don't even understand yet.
After the break, we're talking with political journalist and author Amy Chozick about transforming her memoir into a TV show, one that Simone and I are absolutely obsessed with. Simone, I hear you have a new hosting gig coming up.
You mean besides this podcast?
Yes, this podcast. But also, you're going to be hosting your house on Airbnb?
It's true. I'm going to be traveling a bit coming up, and it felt like the perfect opportunity to earn a little extra cash, baby.
I love your house.
I love my house, too. And it's great for families because it's already set up for traveling with kids. We have bunk beds. We have an extra stroller. We have toys galore. Traveling with kids can be a real challenge, so I'm always looking for ways to make that process easier. When I've stayed at friends' homes or hotels, they don't always have what I need for my family.
That's so true, and you've got it all at your place.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a win-win. I'm not worried about my house sitting empty, and I love that I get to show someone around my neighborhood without having to physically show them around my neighborhood, you know?
While you're out of town for your next adventure, your home could be an Airbnb too. And hey, it might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are so excited to talk with our next guest, journalist and author Amy Chozick. Now, Amy covered politics at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal for many years. She's also the author of the best-selling book Chasing Hillary, which we loved. So it chronicles her experience following Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign.
And since then, Amy has taken on a new role as the co-creator and executive producer of the Max series, The Girls on the Bus. It's loosely based on her book and follows four reporters as they cover a cadre of flawed presidential candidates on the campaign trail. Amy, we're so thrilled to have you on The Bright Side. Welcome to the pod.
Woo! Oh, my God. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks, guys.
Okay, Amy, we'll just dive right in. Although The Girls on the Bus is inspired by your memoir, there's no Hillary,
no.
There's no Trump in the show, which seems like a very deliberate choice, right?
Yes.
Why did you decide to set it in this fictional political landscape?
Well, very early on when I first met one of the producers, Greg Berlanti, we decided it should be a fictional world. No Hillary, no Trump. Partly then it was very raw. It was like 2018, 2019. I think nobody was in the mood to relive 2016. I definitely wasn't. And so for one, we wanted to set it in a fictional world. We also wanted the politics to really be the backdrop, and the friendship, the female friendship that forms on the bus, is kind of the real story. It's a little bit like Friday Night Lights. You don't have to like football to be invested in those characters. So I think if you made it reality, you'd be so focused on sort of the politics. It would attract a different audience, right? It would attract political junkies, I think. And we were going for sort of a broader audience that's interested in female friendship and these relationships with the women. But the great thing about we're playing in this fictional world is that we explored really real themes. I think a lot of the themes from my book are very resonant in the show just through these fictional characters.
So we've been binging.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I love it.
I'm obsessed.
Same.
For me, it's like the best show I've seen in a really long time.
It makes me so happy. Thanks.
And it made me smile. I haven't smiled watching a show in a long time like that. But you mentioned these friendships, and there's four main characters. There's four main women. Who did you base these women off of? Because they are based off of real characters, right?
They're all composites, for sure. I mean, definitely, you know, my journalistic hero, Nora Ephron, said everything is copy. So, you know, of course, I pull different things from real life, but they're all sort of composite characters. Julie Plec and I, who I co-created this with, early on wanted four very different types of women. Generationally, we wanted them to be really different types of journalists. We wanted them to have completely different worldviews. So we kind of started there, and we thought the debates on the bus are going to be much more interesting if they're coming from all of these different perspectives. I mean, Grace is the sort of veteran, the seasoned queen of the scoop, and she's very much inspired by a generation of women who mentored me and a lot of other political reporters at the Times. Maureen Dowd, Jill Abramson, who was the first female editor of the New York Times, and Andrea Mitchell. Andrea was on the bus with us every day, and she was so kind and mentoring, and she's just like slugging it out with us through Ohio with every, you know, with the kids. She's incredible. And I think there was something very early on with these women who are like tough as nails. They don't suffer fools. They'll like cut a bitch for a scoop. But they're so kind and generous. And we just didn't want to fall into the trope of this generation of women who like knocks the ladder down. And I think Grace's character really beautifully sort of ends up mentoring, especially Lola, the young influencer.
We keep bringing up Andrea Mitchell, so I just want to share for anybody who doesn't know. Okay. She's now 77 years old, and she was I think one of the first female political reporters. She's at NBC now and just kind of legendary. The dynamic with the influencer was so interesting to me, particularly because I've always kind of had one foot in digital, one foot in traditional media. And I thought the undertones of those relationships between journalism and influencers were so well thought out and articulated.
And also, can I add the commentary on the tension between old school journalism and traditional journalism and the future of it, where it's headed?
Yeah. I mean, we always wanted an influencer on the bus, but she seemed a little like really fictionalized when we first started. Now I think it's very, it feels very real. It feels like this is the spot when Sadie says sponsored content, the future of journalism, you know, and Substack. That was something like we wouldn't have even put in the script 2 years ago that now feels like a ton of people are getting their political news from podcasts, TikTok, you know. And so, yeah, Lola became even more, I think, realistic. And I think those debates, you know, your former journalists are erupting in newsrooms. I remember when I started and there was like the esteemed veteran journalist saying, we don't vote in elections we cover. Like somebody could find out you're registered Democrat or Republican and think you're biased. So we don't vote. And I was like, oh, I'm going to give up my right to vote. I think my generation sort of started questioning that. But the younger kids are even more so like objectivity. What? You know, I got into this to change the world.
Amy, one of the characters in the show asked one of the best questions I've ever heard from a journalist, real or fake. She said to one of the political candidates, how are you going to break our hearts? I just love how human that question is. Was that a question you've asked before?
To be honest, I was a little embarrassed. You know, I very much worry about what my former colleagues think. And I was like, is that like the softest question ever? And I'm like, but actually, I love that it resonated with you because that's how we feel, right? Like, we feel so like, I just remember when I went to like Obama, I was covering Obama's rallies and a million people turned out in St. Louis. And it was like this incredible thing. And you have this impending dread. What's going to happen? How are they going to take this guy down? Or what skeleton does this woman have in her closet? Like, I feel like we are so kind of accustomed to that now that nobody can just exist.
But isn't what you mentioned about worrying about how your colleagues would have perceived that question, whether it was too soft, that kind of gets to the disconnect between journalism today and where the audience is.
Yeah.
It's not human enough, right? It's like not getting to the humanity that people really want to see in journalists and media today, I think.
No, I love that was your conclusion, because that's kind of exactly what I wanted to do. One of the big things I wanted to do with the show is like the original Boys on the Bus was really a repudiation of PAC journalism. He was criticizing the way politics was covered. And I think that what we're doing with the show in an indirect way is imagining, you know, if we covered politics differently, would we have different politics? You know? And I think that's really like,
that's a big question.
It is. It's not directly asked, but I think that's the question that each girl is grappling with, right? And I think it, you know, towards the end when they decide to work together, like that's a very different way of covering politics. We are all about the scoop and we're about throwing elbows and I'm going to find out which staffer was fired before you do. And it's like, then you've got like voters who are, wait, how's this going to impact my life? Yeah. Or like, was this a good candidate who just got thrown out of the race for some, you know, bullshit scandal? So I think that's what we're sort of imagining with this.
You really centered sisterhood in this show. And also, I was so heartened by the empathy between these characters because they're so different. They don't have to have empathy for each other.
Yeah.
They're across political aisles and ideologies, and they work for these outlets that are enemies, sworn enemies. So how did your found family on the campaign trail inform the friendships that we see in this show?
It definitely did, you know, and I think that the bus was like a great vehicle for that, right? Because these are women I would have never like made friends with Andrea Mitchell in normal life, you know, not because she's not lovely, just because like where would we even have met? But you're forced together on a bus, right? It's almost like those early seasons of The Real World, you know, what happens when people stop being polite, because you're forced together. You're all staying in the same mid-range hotel rooms. Your life is not your own. You know, your personal life is a dumpster fire because you're just giving it all up for the job. And I think, you know, I've seen some criticism of the show of like, in what world would an influencer, would like a progressive influencer be friends with like a conservative, you know, black woman? And I'm like, in our world, in the world I created. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the—
That's the whole point.
Yeah. And that's the privilege of writing for television, right? Is we can imagine the world as we want it to be, not as it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that was, you know, both in my own life, being friends with women I never would have normally met, but also just being able to imagine a world where they can see each other as human.
There is this one scene that I cannot get out of my mind. And one of the characters is having a disagreement with her daughter because she wants her mom to pay more attention to her and not be so focused on work. And the mom says, "My work is the first line in my obituary. You, my dear, are the last." Oh, I got, like, I had so many emotions. It was hard to watch, honestly.
Well, I think partly because Carla is so incredible. She brings such empathy to that scene. But definitely one of the, look, we all read, the whole writer's room, you know, read The Boys on the Bus. This is about the men covering the 1973 McGovern campaign. The only women in that book are like waiting at home to welcome their great men home from their great job on the campaign trail, doing important work. They've got the meatloaf in the oven. I don't think any of those men's children were like, "Why the hell weren't you there for my ballet recital?" I don't think any of those men had to answer for putting their jobs first, right? Mm. And so what, I mean, I love the obituary line, but I also just love that Grace says, "I was out making the money," you know? And it's like, I don't think any man has to answer for that. In every character, we're sort of grappling with these things that that women have to face that I don't think the previous generation ever had to answer for.
It's also just honest. I worked with a lot of women like that, yeah. And I saw a lot of women like that in my field. So it's just nice to have an honest portrayal of ambitious women. Okay, Amy, there's a storyline about a female reporter navigating a tricky romantic relationship with a press secretary. And that kind of conflict of interest is something that we've seen a lot in stories about female journalists. Yeah. But I know that there's an intention behind it. Yeah. So what was it?
Well, I would say I don't think we've seen exactly this. Okay. I think the trope that myself and other female journalists do not appreciate in film and TV is the female journalist is sleeping with a source to get information. Like, she would have never gotten that scoop on her own. She had to flash her tits and sleep with the guy. Like, it's always that. So it's something that was really important to me. I sit down, you know, to brainstorm this show, and my partners are like, "But they're like, she has to have sex with someone, you know? It's a TV show." Like, they kept pitching people, "What about this and this?" And I was like, no, she could never do that. It's a complicated romantic entanglement, which is something we see in Washington all the time because, as in Hollywood, it's like an incestuous one-industry town, and who are you gonna meet, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that we've gotten some criticism for Sadie's choice, but I have never heard one person say, "That press secretary really should have told her he was still employed." Like, no one's ever criticized the male, quote-unquote, source or press secretary. No, I've not seen one thing saying, "That guy, he should have known that was a conflict. That was bad." Not one. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was one article that called Sadie a slut. And I was like, hooked up with her ex-boyfriend when she thought he was unemployed, you know? So it's been very interesting to see the reaction to that. And I definitely agree. I definitely, you know, encourage debate. And I understand not everybody will like that choice that we made. But I do think it's realistic in Washington that you have, like, complicated romantic entanglements. And I think we see Sadie pay very dearly for that in a way that I'm not sure you would see a man have to answer for. And that was what we wanted to do.
You're really reading the reactions to the show and the reviews. You're taking it all in.
I really shouldn't. I'm starting to block.
But what do you think drives that? Are you just curious about what people say about it, or what is it?
I'm just like a masochist. I don't know what to say. No, I'm curious. I mean, you put something out in the world and you want to know how it's being received. And I think since this is the first TV project, you know, my partners are like, "I never read. What are you doing? I never read any of that." You know, but I think this is from, I read the early ones. I'm not really reading them anymore. But yeah, I was curious.
I mean, you're also making a lot of cultural commentary on the show. So you're probably a cultural critic. You're interested in hearing the conversation is around that.
Better than a masochist. Thank you.
That's how I feel. I feel a little enchanted by politics sometimes to this day. And you've covered several presidential campaigns and momentous firsts for our country. So former President Barack Obama, who was obviously the first Black president, both of Hillary Clinton's campaigns to try to become the first female president. And I'm so curious about your personal experience in witnessing these historical moments. Were you enchanted by, I mean, like Obama's hope? Yeah. It was all about hope. The country was so riled up and excited. And Hillary, everyone was, regardless of her politics, excited about the possibility there. Were you enchanted by it on the bus?
Well, I love that you're still enchanted because I feel like most of the country isn't. And we should be, right? We should be, even if it's maybe not this election. There's still the future, right?
Yeah.
But no, I mean, It's a mix, right? I had been a foreign correspondent in Japan before my editor, the Asia bureau chief, became the Washington bureau chief and said, how'd you like to go to Iowa and cover Hillary Clinton? So, like, I hardly knew. This was 2007. I hardly knew who Obama was. I had no idea what a caucus was. I'm like, America doesn't really know what a caucus is either. It's fine. But
we still don't, by
right,
the way.
We still don't. At one point, I went to a Hillary rally, one of my first, and I stood up and she said something great and everybody cheered. And I stood up and cheered and all the press were like, what are you doing? Sit down.
We don't cheer.
And so it's like going.
You were inspired.
I was inspired. And then I realized that we have to seed our ability to be inspired as journalists, right? We have to seed our ability to get, you know, so excited and wrapped up in candidates. And certainly covering Obama's 2008 campaign, when you felt this like groundswell of enthusiasm and part of you was like, oh, that looks amazing. And I'm sitting in the press, you know, pen, unable to react to any of it. And then, you know, but certainly there were moments in my career where it's impossible not to feel the gravity of the moment. Like in 2008, I'm with Obama when the results are coming in. We ride over to the motorcade to Grant Park. I'm like, behind backstage when he's giving his acceptance speech to become the first black president. It's like you have, this is really the objectivity debate. It's like, are you human? Like, are you getting the chills in this moment? Because this is incredible. You know, it's incredible to witness history, right? That's the luxury of being a journalist. We don't get paid a lot, you know, but we get to witness history.
Yeah. I've always thought of journalists, particularly print journalists, as like first draft historians. And so to be witnessing all that, I don't know, it seems like an incredible experience you must have had.
It is. You're like so exhausted and there's like so much whining, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, what am I going to be fed? I need my Marriott points. And like there's all this whining. And
so
you're
real.
Like, there's tea. You're so exhausted. You haven't slept in days. Your editors are asking you for like 15 different stories. And can you have a feed? And I need some color. And can you get some voter voices? And it's like, you really have to stop and be like, this is fucking cool. Like, this is amazing. This is a privilege.
We'll be right back.
Stay with us. Simone, I hear you have a new hosting gig coming up.
You mean besides this podcast?
Yes, this podcast. But also, you're going to be hosting your house on Airbnb?
It's true. I'm going to be traveling a bit coming up, and it felt like the perfect opportunity to earn a little extra cash, baby.
I love your house.
I love my house, too. And it's great for families because it's already set up for traveling with kids. We have bunk beds. We have an extra stroller. We have toys galore. Traveling with kids can be a real challenge, so I'm always looking for ways to make that process easier. When I've stayed at friends' homes or hotels, they don't always have what I need for my family.
That's so true, and you've got it all at your place.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a win-win. I'm not worried about my house sitting empty, and I love that I get to show someone around my neighborhood without having to physically show them around my neighborhood, you know?
While you're out of town for your next adventure, your home could be an Airbnb, too. And hey, it might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. I'm here with Amy Chozick. You covered Hillary's 2016 campaign, and you've seen several women enter presidential races since then. We now even have a female vice president. How do you think we as a group look at women in power right now in 2024? Has it changed?
Sadly, I don't think it's changed that much. And it's really interesting because we started writing this show, you know, a few years ago, and we kept kind of adjusting it as the world changed. And the one big thing that would have, like, drastically impacted the show is, well, we have a woman president. You know, it's like, nope, that doesn't look like it's going to happen. We're fine. We're good. a couple things. One thing is I do think we've evolved a little bit past the Hillary era in that we've seen a lot of different women run for president, whether that's all the women that ran in 2020 on the Democratic side or even Nikki Haley. I think that our only template for a powerful woman was Hillary, who was very, you know, very much qualified on her own, but also seen in the shadow of her husband.
Yes.
And so we have seen a lot of women from a lot of different templates that do not involve, you know, rising to fame with being a wife, right? So I think that has been something that's different and evolved and positive, right? We've seen multiple women on the campaigns on the debate stage. I remember when Hillary was running in it was like 2015, and people were talking about, well, is Elizabeth Warren going to run? And, well, there can't be two women on the stage. It's going to be a catfight. You know, there was just like nobody could even perceive of how two women would debate each other. So, like, even seeing multiple women on the debate stage in 2020, I think was really positive. I mean, one of the things our show does is I think it's one of the first shows to imagine female candidates that very much aren't in the Hillary template, right? And, of course, there's themes that I learned from covering Hillary that work in heavily to the show. But, like, even the wardrobe.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say the aesthetic,
yeah,
right? Because
yeah.
she had the hair and the pantsuit, and it became such a thing for women.
Yes. Yeah, so there are things like that we just we can't even envision a woman in power who's, like, not dressed like that. And that is essentially, that pantsuit look was essentially trying to emulate a man, right? So,
yeah.
So I think we've evolved a little, but sadly not as much as I'd hoped.
There's this scene where Felicity, like, burns her bra.
Yeah.
which to me felt like the only moment where I was like, this would never happen.
Yeah.
But to that point,
yeah.
do you feel like writing in these fictional characters, women running for president or in any sort of power position that are doing things that seem unbelievable now, are moving the narrative forward for actual candidates to sort of start to step into things that we haven't seen before?
I hope so. I mean, I think at its best, TV can influence culture. Bra burning actually comes from a real situation. In 2008, I was with Hillary in New Hampshire, and she was doing a rally, and all these guys stood up and started chanting, "Iron my shirt. Iron my shirt." I guess
wow.
it's like this sexist chant that, and they kept, and she just kind of kept pressing, you know, she just pressed on with her policy. She just ignored them and pressed on. And so in my head, I was like, what if she really leaned into that? What if she called them out? What if she took off her shirt and said, "You fucking ironed it"? But that was one of those scenarios where, like, instead of creating reality in the show, create your wish. What do you wish would have happened?
Mm.
And so, like, when Felicity, like, leans into it and takes off her bra, it's like, I could actually see that, you know, they call it the bra bump. She gets a bump in the polls. You know, what happens when you actually respond the way, you know, you wish you could, that you never really could? And then the other thing is, like, you know, the Joanna Gleason plays Caroline Bennett, the front runner in the pilot, and then she flames out. And what I love about her is that she flames out in her own sex scandal, not her husband's sex scandal. You know, so
it's a great,
that was,
and it's like so
like
juicy.
Women,
it's like this threesome cult thing. Like
there are
totally,
mangoes involved.
It's totally random, but like it was just fun to envision of a boomer woman flaming out because of her own sex scandal. We deserve sex scandals too.
So, for anyone listening who doesn't realize this, the fact that Amy made the move from reporting to screenwriting as a career jump is really remarkable because so many journalists dream of doing that. So I want to talk about that pivot for a moment. How did that pivot test you?
Oh, God, it definitely did. I mean, I feel like this has been, well, for one, I don't want to give you too long of a response, but I was always felt like a creative writer. I studied poetry in college. I like moved to New York. No job, no apartment. I had a stack of clips from the Daily Texan thinking I could be a journalist, but like, well, how am I going to support myself as a poet? I didn't have a trust fund, you know, no one paying my rent. So I temped at a bunch of magazines. I eventually got a job as the news assistant on the foreign desk at the Wall Street Journal. And I just fell in love with journalism. I did that for a really long time. But when I wrote my book and I got to kind of write in my own voice versus newspaper voice, it just reminded me that like I really want to be a creative writer. So in a way, transitioning to screenwriting felt like my soul had come alive. Like,
wow.
I could be, like, creative again. I could play with my imaginary friends,
aww,
as I say. But yeah, it was like a real endurance. It's like an endurance sport. I mean, this has taken 5 years and three networks. You know, it was so many rewrites, rewriting the scripts until you think you can't possibly rewrite anymore. And just continuing to find joy and, you know, surprise in these characters we created, even when you have so many rounds of notes and so many challenges. So it wasn't an easy thing, but I've really, really loved it.
Was it worth it?
It was worth it, yes. It was worth it to put this. I'm really proud of what we put out in the world. I mean, to your point, we were talking earlier, is like that we got to envision this world as we wish it would be. Yeah, I think it was worth it. I relocated my whole family to Los Angeles. My husband's Irish. He still thinks it's relentlessly sunny here.
Big swings.
Yeah.
To move your whole family's big.
Yeah. I feel like you have to go like all in, you know? But it was hard. It was hard to leave the New York Times, too. And my whole kind of identity was wrapped up in being a Times reporter.
Yeah.
Have you found a new placeholder for that identity, like a new title? Or are you good with sort of the undefined role?
It's interesting. I feel like here I just live much more of a writer's life. You know, I don't necessarily need to be like defined in a way I felt like I did there. Maybe because New York is just New York, or because you're always going into rooms being like, I'm with the New York Times. You know, and I feel like here I just like really enjoy, you know, playing with my imaginary friends and moving words on the page. And
you get to be Amy.
Yeah.
This must be so liberating for you as a creative to be able to live in this playground. I mean, coming from the newspaper world, from journalism, where you're held to such tight and high standards, you're free now.
Yeah, it was. There were definitely scenes that were really cathartic. There's a scene at the end when Sadie has a conversation with Felicity Walker that is like a conversation that I've had in my head for 8 years. I have to say, it was really a peak life experience to be able to turn something that was painful into art. And I know it's making TV, but I'm still going to call it art.
It's
and
art.
That was really cathartic. It was.
Amy, thank you so much for being here
with
us.
It's so fun to talk to you, and I'm so thrilled you like the show. It means a lot.
Oh, we love it.
Yay.
Amy Chozick is a journalist, screenwriter, and creator of the new TV series, The Girls on the Bus. It's streaming now on Max, so catch the season finale on May 9th. I promise you, you won't regret it.
Hopefully the listeners can feel the energy in the room because it was really electric.
Well, it's so fun to sit with another journalist, right?
Yeah.
Like we get into the X's and O's and shared experiences and differences. It's fun, but I could tell that you are really interested in people's transitions.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that question you asked her at the end about, was it all worth it?
Totally. And I gained a lot from hearing Amy talk about hers. I love that she did say, yes, this pivot was worth it in the end. You can tell that she just has this like renewed purpose now that she's on this different career path. She said that her soul really came alive becoming a screenwriter and transitioning out of journalism. And also, what she's doing is really powerful. She is creating the world that she wants to see through her art.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for today's show, folks. Tomorrow, comedian Mary Beth Barone is here. She's redefining comedy on her own terms, and she shares some of her most provoking thoughts.
Plus, we're asking for a friend. That's right. We want to know your questions. Do you have a friendship situation you need a little extra guidance with? Send us a voice note to hello@thebrightsidepodcast.com, and one of our Brightside besties is going to help you out.
Listen and follow The Bright Side on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find me, Simone Boyce, on Instagram and TikTok.
And I'm Danielle Robay, @DanielleRobay on Instagram and TikTok. That's R-O-B-A-Y.
We'll see you back here tomorrow. Keep looking on the bright side.
Simone, you may not know this, but I have been bitten by the travel bug. This time of year, I crave the outdoors and the mountains and adventure. They're calling to me.
I mean, we were both in Austin recently for work and also having a time. And as soon as I got home, I was already on Airbnb planning my next trip, possibly this summer. And while I'm away, I'll be hosting my home on Airbnb.
While you're out of town for your next adventure, your home could be an Airbnb too. And hey, it might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.